introduction of the framework, the formalism that we're going to be using. But before that, I would like to start with the main motivation that that led us to start thinking about these things, which is just this simple question. Do gauge anomalies cancel in the standard model? Now, everybody in this room, of course, knows the answer to this question, right? Or you're supposed, in principle, you know, right? But then, if I'm asking the question, it's because I want to make the point that the answer is not as trivial as one might think. So my answer to this question is that, at least before a paper was published, the answer to this question was that maybe they do, maybe they don't, I just don't know. As far as I know, the answer is not in the literature. What do I mean? I mean, you can always, of course, you can just go to Peskin and Schroeder and check out the anomaly cancellation conditions there. It's something that you can just do, right? The point, and this is the main point of this talk, is that it has been recently realized that what you have in Peskin and Schroeder is maybe not the end of the story. People have discovered the existence of finer anomaly cancellation conditions, more restrictive than the stuff that you were studying in the 80s. So far, people have only looked at these things in particular setups related to condensed matter. What we did, we basically took these techniques and tried to apply them to symmetries of interest in quantum theories which are relevant to phenomenology. Okay? So that's in a nutshell the stuff we did. That's in a nutshell what this talk is about. So now that I gave you the motivation, I give you the plan. I will start by reviewing the old stuff of anomalies to just to set up the round rules and how we're going to compute. Then I will review the new story. Both these two things are reviews. There's stuff which was not done by us. It's stuff which is already done in papers. And then I will get to the applications, which is the stuff that we did. We basically took this framework and applied it to a bunch of symmetries which are of interest. So because it's after lunch and this is very well-known stuff, I also drawn this picture, this arrow here to indicate that you can go for a quick nap if you don't care too much about this, and I will be sure to wake you up when we get to the second part. Okay, so anomalies. This is a story from the 80s. So we're going back to the 80s. First things first, what's an anomaly, right? This is first to define concretely what I'm going to be talking about, I will restrict myself to Euclidean signature from the get-go. And on top of that, I will only consider Lagrangian theories, okay? You can also look at anomalies in non-Lagrangian theories, and then the story is much more general than what I will be discussing here, but because I'm interested in Fino in the end, and Fino, you always have a Lagrangian in particle physics anyway, I will be just looking at Lagrangian theories, okay? So when you have a Lagrangian theory, then there's a very nice object that you can compute as the partition function. And if your theory has some symmetry G, you might as well just turn on a background gauge field for this symmetry. Okay, there's a well-defined procedure. Whenever you have a symmetry G, you can basically turn on a background, a non-trivial bundle for G, and then coupled via connection. Okay, so this is just a background gauge field. Now, one says that there's an anomaly whenever the partition function, this partition function that you compute like this, is not gauge invariant. Okay, whenever I make a gauge transformation and this thing changes, then there's an anomaly. Now, what I've discussed, this discussion, it's it works for both the case when the symmetry G is global and also when it's gauged. When it's gauged, you have to sum over all over non-trivial. You have to sum over the gauge orbit. And so if you have an anomaly, the anomaly is lethal. Your theory makes no sense. And you get basically a constraint, which is the constraint of anomaly cancellation. However, I want to emphasize that what are we doing here applies generally, both to global and to gauge symmetries. As far as I would be concerned, there will be no dynamics for the gauge field. I will just look at what happens to the partition function of a fermion when I couple to a background gauge field, okay? So, there's these anomalies can be classified in a variety of ways. A particularly interesting one for us is classification the distinction between local and global anomalies. I said that an anomaly is the non-invariance of the partition function under a gauge transformation. If this gauge transformation is a map from spacetime to the gauge group, if this map can be continuously deformed to the identity, then this is a what I call a local gauge transformation. And if the map cannot be continuously deformed to the identity, if there's a topological obstruction, then this is a global gauge transformation. Now, this terminology can be confusing because it's used in the literature in a number of ways. So for instance, people sometimes also talk about when you're talking in the context of asymptotic symmetries, you talk about gauge transformations that whose gauge parameters does not go to zero when you approach spatial infinity. These are not these guys, okay? So I will always be looking either at theories in compact spaces or in spaces where you can effectively compactify the stuff. So for me, global is just a gauge transformation that you cannot continuously deform to the identity. And again, because I'm interested in particle physics, I will be looking at anomalies of free fermions. Okay, so systems within which you have some couplings, which you can tune away to zero, maybe, and in the end you end up just with a Lagrangian of this form. Okay, because anomalies are topological, they don't really feel you turning on and off couplings as long as these respect the symmetries. This is why we'll be looking at this stuff. Okay. So, how do we deal with these anomalies? This is the stuff that you learn in the master's course, right? For local anomalies, this is very well known. There is the Wessel-Minor-Desser procedure. Turns out, if you are looking at anomalies in a theory in d dimensions, there is a certain polynomial in d plus two dimensions, such that the anomalous variation of the phase of the path integral. Is given by a certain procedure coming from this two-dimensional polynomial. If you have n fermions, you have several fermions in your theory, you're supposed to sum this anomaly polynomial over all fermions. And then if you want anomalies to cancel, because, for instance, maybe this symmetry is gauged, then you impose a standard anomaly cancellation condition. Okay? So how do we go about global anomalies? The way you study global anomalies is slightly more convoluted. I will explain this with one particular example, which is also the first example when you have that came about in which you have a non-trivial global anomaly. Consider a four-dimensional SU2 gauge theory with a one-biot fermion in the fundamental. Okay, this theory is free of local anomalies. If you compute the anomaly polynomial in the previous slide, it vanishes. However, if you put the theory on a sphere, then the gauge transformations are maps from the space, which in this case is S4, to the gauge group, which is SU2. These maps are classified modulo homotopy by this homotopy group here, which happens to be non-trivial. So there's one gauge transformation which is potentially troublesome. How do we find out if there is really an anomaly for this guy? Well, the recipe is as follows. You start with one gauge configuration, the particular gauge configuration you're interested with. This is its gauge transform, where G here is a representative of the non-trivial class here. And then you construct a one-parameter family of connections that interpolates between A0 and A1. Okay, so this you can see as a movie where the connection smoothly interpolates from one to the other. Okay, now you might regard this, if you want, as a gauge field in one dimension more. T is the new coordinate, so this would be a gauge field on a cylinder, which it interpolates from here to here, and then the gauge field changes according to this parameter. But because this guy and this guy are gauge transforms of one another, that means that you can actually patch the two things together. You can patch them consistently to end up with a particular gauge field, a particular non-trivial gauge field on S4 times S1. This is the mapping torus construction. So to analyze the four-dimensional gauge transformation that we're interested in, we construct a five-dimensional gauge field, a five-dimensional connection on a particular five-dimensional background. And then the analysis tells us that, well, in this five-dimensional theory, you can also define a particular kind of Dirac fermion. The Dirac operator of this fermion couples to the bundle we just constructed in five dimensions, and you can compute a topological invariant associated to this five-dimensional Dirac operator, which is called the modulo 2 index. And this mod 2 index, which only can be 0 or 1, basically tells you whether or not there's an anomaly. After you do that, it's just a matter of computing, and it turns out that in this case, there is an anomaly. Okay? So this is how you analyze global anomalies in general. And the take-home message, the thing that will be relevant for us later, is the way you compute this thing is by introducing a higher dimensional auxiliary theory. Okay? Very good. So this is the story from the 80s. Now we're going back to the future. So what has happened recently? What is the what are the new ideas that we'll be using here? So to describe what the new idea is, let me just go back to the original problem that we had. We just want to compute the partition function of a free fermion system. But this is supposed to be easy, right? It's just, I mean, it's a free fermion system. The path integral is quadratic. You can solve it explicitly. It's a product of eigenvalues, which turns out to be the Pfaffian of the Dirac operator. Why do I write the Pfaffian and not the determinant as you're used to? This expression is general. So it covers the case when you have real fermions, complex fermions. The point is that fermions, the structure of fermion representations in Dirac operators is very rich, depending on the gauge group, the dimensionality where you're working, a bunch of stuff. The Dirac operator changes significantly. However, there is one property which is universal, which is always works, which is that the Dirac operator is always anti-symmetric, okay? Because of Fermi statistics. You use the Dirac operator to construct a Lagrangian, and the fermions are the anti-commute. So you can always define the Pfaffian, and indeed, this is the result of the partition function, okay? Now, like I said, if the Pfaffian, the partition function, is not a well-defined function of the connection, then there is an anomaly. So the way you think about this, you can think of the partition function as a function that takes gauge fields over space-time and produces a complex number, right? So it's a function over an infinite dimensional space, the space of all possible gauge configurations on, sorry, the background connections over the space that you're interested in. If there is an anomaly, you would like this thing to be a well-defined function. But if there is an anomaly, it isn't. It's ambiguous. It's kind of like multi-value. So the natural structure that you would use to describe a multi-value complex function over a space is a bundle. And indeed, what happens is that even when, in general, the Pfaffian is not a function, it's a section of a particular line bundle over this space of configurations. When the bundle is trivial, then you can define the whole thing uniquely, and there is no anomaly. Okay, so now we get to the main technical tool that we'll be using during the talk, which is the Dieffrey theorem. The Dieffrey theorem, basically, for our purposes here, what it does, it tells us that there is another quantity, which I have not defined yet, this guy, which is also the face of a section of the Pfaffian line bundle, okay? What that means is that this thing is actually a section of a trivial bundle, okay? Or equivalently, that you, if you want, you could morally, as far as the topology of the thing is concerned, you could replace the Pfaffian by this guy, this mysterious eta guy, okay? The modulus of the partition function, it's never anomalous. It's always well-defined. This is so because you can always introduce, in this context of Lagrangian theories, you can always introduce complex conjugate fermions. And with that, you can basically always define the absolute value of the partition function, but the phase isn't. The interesting thing, what this theorem is doing for us from this point of view, is it's giving us a different thing that we can compute instead of of evaluating this product directly. And of course, the whole point is that this thing, in some cases, is easier to compute. So what is this thing? This eta. This eta is the so-called eta invariant of a certain Dirac operator, but the definition is kind of roundabout, okay? So to compute the eta invariant associated to a particular gauge configuration, you are supposed to do the following. You start with your theory in some manifold X. You want to compute the anomaly of this manifold. Then you're supposed to find a Y, some other manifold Y with one dimension more, such that the boundary of y is x, then all the fields that you have on x, you're supposed to extend to y in some way. And then on y, because you have extended, you had a gauge field on x, now you extend it to y, you have a Dirac operator on y. And because it's a Dirac operator and a manifold with boundary, you have to impose boundary conditions. And if you impose the right boundary conditions, you can ensure this guy's self-adjoint. If it's self-adjoint, then you can compute, basically, you can diagonalize it. It's got real eigenvalues. And eta is basically a regularized sum of the eigenvalues. OK? So that's the definition of eta. And so far, this doesn't seem like any progress at all. It seems like things more complicated. Now I have to diagonalize a d plus one dimensional operator. I started with a d dimensional operator, so this whole exercise doesn't seem too smart so far.
What is lambda?
Sorry. This is a sum over the eigenvalues. You take the Dirac operator with APS boundary conditions self-adjoint. So this is just a sum of the eigenvalues.
Okay. Is the boundary condition local?
To be honest, I don't know. I just I think a generalized APS boundary conditions are not local, but I really don't know. Sorry. I'm basically using this as a recipe to compute the anomaly. Then you can pick them local at one point of the configuration space, but then they, as you go around to the zeros, they change. But sorry. Okay.
I'm sorry, what if you cannot choose the gen y or you cannot extend your field?
Very good question. So it can sometimes happen that you cannot extend x to y. When that happens, the procedure that I will be describing to compute the phase of the Pasch integral is ambiguous. And this ambiguity is related to, it's a physical ambiguity, it's related to topological terms that you can have in the in the action, there are physical couplings. So, for instance, sometimes this, whether or not you can extend x to y, it's controlled by a Bordesian group. So, for instance, if this Bordesian group is Cn, that means that I cannot extend x to a y, but I can extend n copies of x to y. So, the phase that I get for the partition function in this case is defined. It has a I can only define the nth power of the partition function. So there's an ambiguity, and that's different. That's a physical parameter. Different theories have different values of the parameter. For instance, in the case where instead of a Zn, it's Z, this parameter is basically, it can be the theta angle associated to the gauge. Different theta angles get to different, they give you different phases. Okay? So, like I said, you're supposed to take the gauge field in x and extend it to y. Okay? But I didn't tell you how to do it, right? And in principle, there might be different ways in which you can extend x to y. And in this language, this is how you see that there's an anomaly. The anomaly. The anomaly means that there's the mapping from x to y is not well defined. The physics depends on the particular choice of y. There's a similar story that that might be more familiar. Suppose that instead of talking about fermions, I want to describe a Chern-Simons theory. I want to study that Chern-Simons theory in three dimensions. Okay, the simplest thing, just a U1 Chern-Simons theory, something like this. Now, this expression is dangerous because gauge fields are only defined patchwise. So if I'm in a complicated manifold, then the expressions for the gauge field in two patches might not agree. So how do I define it? A simple way that you can go around this problem is just to find a y such that x is the boundary of y. If you can do this, then you can integrate this thing over y, which is better defined. It's just the field strength of the gauge field, gauge invariant, and whatever. Okay. But now, of course, the question is whether what you just did depends on your choice of y. How do you check this? Well, you pick two possible extensions, y1 and y2, and compute the difference, see if they agree or not. So you compute the difference, and basically that's the integral of f wedge f over the d plus one dimension, the four manifold that you get from gluing y1 and y2 along the boundary. Okay? So in this case, the thing is well defined because this integral is always an integer. The eta invariant has similar properties, and then basically to have a theory which is anomaly free means that one should do the same thing. Basically, that the exponentiating eta invariant should be 1 over any closed d plus 1 dimensional manifold y, which you get by gluing these two guys. Okay, so bottom line in this analysis, in this language, whether or not you have an anomaly comes from looking at this thing and whether or not it vanishes. It's trivial. Okay? So this is the general analysis, and now let's connect with the stuff that was happening in the 80s. Let me look. I'm supposed to look at this thing for any closed dimensional d plus 1 manifold y. So let me look at two particular cases. Y's that are themselves d plus 1 manifolds, which are themselves boundaries of d plus 2 dimensional manifolds, and mapping to right. Okay. So for the first case, if y is the boundary of some z, okay, then we can use the APS index theorem, which is an extension of the index theorem, to manifolds with boundary, which tells us that if you extend the gauge field from y to z, there is another there's another Dirac operator on z, and the index of z, which is always an integer, is equal to the eta invariant of y plus this term. Okay?
Which is just the usual index density.
So taking exponentials of both sides, you see that the eta invariant, it's basically equal to the anomaly polynomial that you got from the 80s. And then this thing is integrated on C, which is a manifold with boundaries. So in general, it's not quantized. It's not. It has no particular special properties. So the way you can ensure that this vanishes in general is by just demanding that the integral vanishes, which was the requirement for local anomaly cancellation in the 80s. Okay. Now, there's also a bonus that we get once we impose this condition, once we impose cancellation of local anomalies, which is that once you do that, the eta invariant that we're computing becomes a topological invariant. It's no longer sensitive to infinitesimal changes of the gauge field and metric that we were looking, that we were trying to construct before. So for the rest of the talk, I will always be discussing theories in which local anomalies cancel, okay? So this thing will be a topological invariant. Very good. So that's what happens if you look at y's, which are themselves boundaries of z's. And the next question is, what happens for mapping to array? It turns out that the quantity that we compute here, it's basically the same thing that was controlling the global anomaly before. So basically, by looking at the eta invariant in mapping to array, you recover absence of global anomalies. Okay, so we recover all the anomaly cancellation conditions that we had from the 80s, and yet it seems that here we have more. We haven't. We might naturally ask what happens if we demand this thing is 1 for any y. What would happen? And the whole point is that if you do this, you get additional constraints. Okay, so imposing this means that you get finer anomaly cancellation conditions, which are the ones I was talking about at the start of the talk, okay? So let me give you one example, which is the first example, and it's to look at the at the topological superconductor. This is a system of Majorana fermions in a possibly non-orientable three-dimensional space. If you look at the if you look at traditional anomalies from the 80s, there's a global gravitational anomaly which sees a modulo 8. It's a modulo 8 constraint. It tells you that the theory is anomalous under unless the number of fermions is a multiple of 8. However, if you look at the 8 invariant of RP4, which is, as far as I know, you cannot recast as a mapping torus, then you see a modulo 16 constraint. So you get a stronger constraint. So that's potentially interesting. Once you have that for one theory, you might wonder if you have it for any other symmetry, any other theory. Before I discuss what are the consequences of studying these stronger anomaly cancellation constraints, I should try and discuss a little bit why should this anomaly cancel. Well, first of all, you can get somewhere. You can get consistency conditions that impose non-trivial constraints if you demand that you should be able to you should be allowed to cut the theory and glue it, kind of like when you do quantization or a cross-dimension wide surface and then you introduce some over states, and also reflection positivity, that's unitarity. Basically, there are some of these theories in which the 8 invariant does not cancel for some manifolds would lead, if you use those manifolds as boundary conditions to define a state in the theory, it can lead to states which have negative norm. So there are some constraints, but it's not obvious that you have to, and there are some constraints, and it's clear that if you impose that the 8 invariant should vanish for every manifold, these constraints are satisfied. However, it's not completely clear to me that it is also a necessary condition. We also have another motivation, which comes from a more, which is particularly maybe relevant if you're thinking about the standard model as we were thinking, because the standard model is a theory that at the end of the day you have to couple to gravity. In gravity, one might wonder about topology change. We know there are some cases in which topology change is necessary in gravity theories. For instance, in area CFT, to describe the Hawking phase phase transition, one has to sum over topologies. This, of course, doesn't mean that any topology or any topology changing process is allowed in a generic quantum theory of gravity, but that makes it an interesting thing to wonder. So if you take this point of view, then the more general anomalies are not that weird. And in the end, there are some sort of mapping torus in which the topology can change. Okay, so this is the mapping torus I was describing before. Like I said, you can view it as a movie that interpolates the Gauge field from here to here. Okay, and it describes, the Gauge field describes a non-contractible path in configuration space. If you allow for topology change, then maybe you can generalize this picture to something like this. This is also a non-contractible path in configuration space, only that as you go along the path, some baby universes branch out and go back in, or some more weird stuff happens. Okay? If you allow for these things, basically what I'm saying is that allowing for topology change introduces more non-trivial paths in configuration space, and then demanding that these guys also have no anomaly leads to the more general constraints that all anomalies should cancel. Okay, so I'm getting there, getting to the applications finally. But before I do that, there is one important caveat that one should always keep in mind. And that's the Green-Schwarz mechanism. This is familiar from local anomalies. Sometimes you can have a theory with local anomalies, and you can get away with the anomalous spectrum because you introduce a Green-Schwarz term. So you introduce a new field with a particular coupling, the Green-Schwarz coupling, and the theory is completely fine. Okay? Now, when you're doing this for a local anomaly, you have to introduce extra light degrees of freedom. There's no way to have the green source without introducing new XLI degrees of freedom. And that the extra degrees of freedom basically make the gauge field become massive and so on. So it's quite a drastic change of the theory, if you will. However, for these global anomalies, it turns out that you can roughly do the same thing in some cases by coupling to a particular topological quantum field theory, which has the same anomaly as the fermions, or that forbids the anomalous background. So it basically tells you that one of these Dyfried anomalies that you were looking at is actually not is not relevant. And because this is a global anomaly, it's a more subtle thing, the theory that you have to introduce to cancel the anomaly has no extra local degrees of freedom. So if you're a phenomenologist, you wouldn't tell. You wouldn't know how to distinguish these two possibilities, right? There are no extra local degrees of freedom. So this is something that one should keep in mind, particularly because we don't have a classification. We don't know, at least I don't know, I don't know in general how to tell if a particular theory with particular fermions and particular gauge group, its anomaly can be canceled by a topological quantum field theory in this way. This is an obstacle, and this is important, if you're talking about anomalies in gauge symmetries. When you have a gauge symmetry, you want the anomalies to cancel. And this is telling you that sometimes you can get rid of some constraints by looking at this. By having a Green-Schwarz mechanism. However, there's another application of this whole story, and that's tuft anomaly matching. When you have an anomaly in a global symmetry, and you have, for instance, some non-trivial RG flow, the anomalies in the UV and the IR have to match. And this is also true for these more general Dyfried anomalies. And in this case, the Green-Schwarz term is not a problem. Okay. So we finally get, this is basically what was done before. And finally we get to what we did, which is basically apply this formalism to study symmetries in particle physics of interest, okay? So yeah, just to mention again, you know the story. These anomalies have only been studied in a few systems. And a priori, once you discover that these new anomalies exist, they could be there for any system. So we applied it to particle physics. And in particular, the question that we're interested in is the standard model Dyfried anomalies? Okay? So how do we do this? Well, to analyze Dyfried anomalies for a general symmetry, we have some more technology which is useful. I mentioned before that when local anomalies cancel, the error invariant is a topological invariant, but actually a stronger property is true. It's actually a Bordism invariant. That means that if you have two t plus one dimensional manifolds, y1 and y2, and they are the boundary of a d plus two dimensional manifold, which I drew here, in such a way that all the relevant structures, like spin structure, gauge boundary, whatever, extend here, then the eta invariant of this guy is the eta invariant of this guy. Okay? So, that means, that means that the eta invariant is just a function of, not of manifolds, but of equivalence classes of manifolds modulo Bordism. Now, this equivalence, relation actually defines a group. There's a group structure. The group operation is an abelian group. The group operation is just the disjoint union of manifolds. And basically, what this means is that the eta invariant. Which is basically a phase, it's a map from the spin Bordism group to U1, okay? So we just have to classify homomorphisms from the Bordism group to U1. This is particular notation, which describes basically the equivalence classes modulo Bordism of manifolds with a spin structure and a principal G bundle. So G here is whatever group we're interested in. OK? The nice thing is that you can compute these groups. There are techniques that allow you to compute these groups, like the spectral, via spectral sequences. So the general strategy that we'll follow is this. We will first compute the relevant Bordism group. If the Bordism group vanishes, there's no anomaly, because the homomorphism from zero to whatever. If the manifold is, if the Bordesian group is non-trivial, then we have to find a representative of a non-trivial class and compute this guy. And again, it might happen, and even if the Bordesian group is trivial, the particular homomorphism that is given to us by the particular fragments in our theory is trivial, in which case there will be no new anomaly. Only if these two things they don't happen, there is a new anomaly. And you should also keep in mind, always, in the back of your mind, there's always the possibility of Green-Schwarz terms, okay? So it's also, this is also something that you'll see will show up later. Okay? So, these are our, this is the bulk of what we did. This is our results. We basically computed all these Bordesian groups using the spectral sequence. These are the results for just for semi-simple Lie groups. And we could have gone further in some cases. In some cases, we could not get too high up. Whenever you see this, this is an extension that we were not able to determine. So the Athiyar-Hirzebruch spectral sequence only produces a filtration of your of the groups you're interested in. And then to compute the actual groups, you have to solve a non-trivial extension problem. And in some cases, we fail to solve this. But for instance, these guys can either be Z2 plus Z2 or Z4. There are not many. There's a finite number of possibilities. OK? So yeah, this is the result in general. And if you're a particle physicist, you're particularly interested in this column.
Yeah. What do the numbers on the second row indicate? 0, 1, 2, 3, 4.
Oh, sorry, that's the dimension, OK? Sorry, yeah, that's this, sorry, yes.
OK.
0 dimensions, 1, 2, 3, yeah.
Okay. The reason everything is 0 and 3.
Sorry?
Why is everything 0 along the 3?
Oh, that you can understand, that's like the standard statement that, well, you can prove in general using properties of, it's related to the fact that the first homotopy groups of semi-simple Lie groups are understood and are simple. So basically, when you write down the spectral sequence, for instance, the pi 2 of any semi-simple Lie group vanishes. So it's that shows up there and in the end leads to this result. This is for semi-simple Lie groups. We don't hold more general.
What is the meaning of choosing?
Oh?
Choosing.
Choose. Choose. Oh, sorry. That's just Z plus Z. It's two copies of Z, sorry. Yeah, and that's, yeah, so you get some discrete groups in some more interesting cases here, but yeah, that's it. So if you're a particle physicist, you're interested in this guy. Because this is the fifth column that controls the anomalies of four-dimensional gauge groups, OK? So yeah, you look at this column, it's not particularly interesting, right? There's only a couple of Z2s, which come from SU2 and USP. These Z2s, they actually control they are actually related to Witten's SU2 anomaly that we were discussing before. So they are not new. The anomaly also exists for USP, so that's why there's another C2 there. So for semi-simple Lie groups in four dimensions, this is maybe not particularly interesting. But we're not interested in semi-simple Lie groups principle, right? The thing we're interested in is a standard model, right? The standard model gauge group. Now, as you probably know, we don't know what the global structure of the gauge group of the standard model is. What we've measured in colliders is just gauge bosons, which live in the algebra. And there's actually not one, but four different possibilities for the global structure of the standard model gauge group, which are compatible with the observations and, well, also with the Fermi spectrum that we have. So all of these possibilities can be described as quotients of SU3 times SU2 times U1 by some discrete group gamma, or gamma can be one of these guys, okay? And then this Z6, this is the maximal subgroup, contains these other two guys. Okay, so yeah, in principle, it could happen that these guys have different diaphragm anomalies. If that were the case, that would be awesome, because we would be able maybe to discriminate one choice for the standard model gauge group versus another. So let's get down to it. Because these guys are subgroups of this guy, that means that if you choose gamma equals Z6, the biggest quotient here, this choice is kind of maximal. Any bundle that you can have with gauge group where this is Z6, it's also a bundle for 1, Z2, and Z3. And as you go further to the left in the list, you have less and less bundles. That means that C6 is the possibility which potentially is the most anomalous. Okay? So if you're looking for new anomalies, you should look at Z6 first and then try to understand the other guys. Okay? Luckily, Z6 has also another nice property, which is that it's the guy that embeds in SU5. So when you pick gamma equals to Z6, then this guy becomes a subgroup of SU5. This is the subgroup that you actually get in SU5 ground unification models. And of course, the whole point of SU5 ground unification is that the Fermion spectrum also falls in SU5 representations. So any bundle that you can have like this, it's also an SU5 bundle, because this group embeds in SU5. And the fermions fall in SU5 representations. What this means is that as far as anomalies are concerned, the standard model is actually equivalent to SU5. The anomalies are the same. And I just showed you a table in which you could see that the anomalies of SU5 vanish. Okay? So the standard model is free of diaphragm anomalies. So there are no new anomalies here. The same thing happens for SU5 ground unification and also for spin 10. Okay, so if you look at spin 10, there's also no new diaphragm anomalies. So, yep, that's a bummer. Is there something we can do about it? Well, depending on your point of view, it might actually be good news, but is there something we can do about it? Okay, so we try to do something about it. So we have to start doing weird stuff to get more anomalies. One thing that could come up to your mind is this whole formalism of diaphragm anomalies was originally applied to fermions in unorientable spaces. Can we get the standard model in unorientable space? Well, the answer that comes to your mind right away is, of course, no, because, well, if you put a theory in an unorientable space, you put fermions in an unorientable space, that means that there is a path that you can follow in your space, and once you go back, your fermions come back reflected. They get the action of a reflection. So for such a theory to make sense, it better be the case that that the reflections are a symmetry of the theory. And this is just not the case in the standard model. Parity is out of the question. Standard model is a chiral theory. It breaks parity as much as it can. What about CP? You could use CP as your reflection symmetry. However, this is also broken in the standard model. There are some phases in the CKM matrix that break CP. However, the breaking is much milder than the one for parity. The spectrum of the standard model is invariant under CP. It's just broken by some coupling in the Lagrangian. So you might entertain the possibility that maybe this breaking is spontaneous. Maybe this phase of the CKM matrix that breaks CP is actually the web of some field, and maybe if you're lucky, it makes sense to tune the web of this field back to zero so that you get rid of CP violation, while also hoping that the rest of the theory doesn't change too much while you do that. Now, this is an extra assumption. Okay, this might not be the case. But if you assume it's the case, then it makes sense to have the standard model in non-orientable spaces. For instance, if you like string Fino, then you would like to get the standard model at some point from some weird compactification of M theory, and because M theory preserves CP, then the breaking should be spontaneous. Just as a point of principle, when you have fermions in non-orientable manifold, you need a generalization of spin structure, which is called pin structure. There are two such pin structures, pin plus and pin minus. They differ on how the square of a reflection acts on fermions. It can square to 1 or to minus 1. And well, as a point of principle, just claiming that the theory has to make sense in oriental spaces can indeed a priori introduce new constraints. So for instance, if you start with a six-dimensional theory which only and you look only at spin manifolds, then Bordes group vanishes. But if you look at manifolds which have a pin minus structure, then you get C16. It's important to notice that different manifolds and different non-orientable manifolds admit different pin structures. So there are manifolds that admit a pin plus structure, but not pin minus, and vice versa. So you have to study both cases. Majorana masses only make sense with a pin structure, so maybe you have a bias towards this guy. Anyway, so that's the setup. And this is what we get again. So we computed the Bordesian groups with the spectral sequence, and we found again that they vanished. So there's also not an anomaly, not an anomaly here, even if you impose this on the modern orientable spaces. So classifying space of a shape. Right. So yeah, so they vanish. So is there anything else we can do? We ran out of options, but there's also another interesting option from a point of view of phenomenology. What if we introduce right-handed neutrinos, which we know are there anyway? Well, it's well known that if you introduce right-handed neutrinos, then P minus L, this is a global symmetry of the standard model, which is not broken by instanton or whatever, becomes anomaly-free, okay? So P minus L, it's anomaly-free, it's free of local anomalies, so you might as well gauge it. So let's say it's gauged. And now there's a funny fact. If you look at the charges of the different fermions under B minus L, they're all odd, okay? And that means that you can use B minus L as the U1 gauge field to put the standard model in manifolds with a spin C structure, okay? There are some manifolds which do not admit fermions. They don't have a spin structure, but this pathology can sometimes be fixed if the fermions are charged with the right charges, particular odd charges, under a U1 gauge field. If you do that, then charged fermions make sense in these manifolds, even if untransferred fermions do not. This is what is called a spin C structure. You can also consider the non-orientable generalization spin C structure. In four dimensions, these guys these classes of manifolds are extremely general. Any four-dimensional spin C manifold admits a spin structure. Any four-dimensional oriental manifold admits a spin C structure. Okay, so this is pretty general. So we also computed this, and I guess you can guess the result. Indeed. So there's that. That's depressing. So to lift our spirits, now we are going to look at the success story, at a case where you have non-trivial anomalies. Turns out I have not been talking about the empty set for 50 minutes almost. So let's look at discrete groups. Okay, so just anomalies in Zn groups in four dimensions. These are also interesting for phenomenology, as we will see momentarily. And in this case, we're super lucky. We don't have to work, which is the best thing. Both the Bordesian groups and the Etienne variants were computed by mathematicians, in particular, Gilkey worked a lot on this. Both for spin and spin C cases, turns out the Bordesian groups are non-trivial, and the Etienne variants are non-trivial as well. And on top of that, this is not the first time that people have studied anomalies in Zn symmetries. We can compare with studies in the 90s, which were done by Ibáñez and Ross. The way you study these guys, the way they were studied in the 90s, was by embedding the Zn into a U1 and demanding that the U1 had to be non-anomalous. Now, this is a very strong constraint. It's not obvious that you need to assume this for the theory to make sense. But anyway, you get some constraints. So you basically get two constraints coming from the Zn reduction of the linear and cubic anomaly cancellation constraints. And already in the 90s, people were complaining that these two constraints are not on an equal footing, okay? This one is UV sensitive, meaning that you can add very massive fields with zero net ZN charge, which can alter this number, which means that you can basically cancel the anomaly by always introducing stuff that you cannot see in the IR, while this one, with this one, you cannot do it, okay? So with the dye-free formalism, what we get by studying the particular expressions for the eta invariant is we get the linear constraint. That one we get exactly the same, all right? And something which looks like the cubic Ibanez-Ross constraint. I should mention that there was a paper also at the same time by Sanchez-Xie. He was basically computing the same thing and got the same results as we did. So we get this constraint, okay? And we are not assuming anything about a U1 embedding here. There's nothing, yeah, there's no, we are not assuming anything there. However, you might wonder, because there was trouble with the cubic constraints of Ivanya and Ross, are these guys okay? Well, it turns out that they do have a problem. The problem that they have is precisely that in this case, you can find a topological ring source that kills some of the constraints. And in particular, you can always kill this constraint. So the way you see the old trouble that Ibanez and Ross had with the cubic constraint is because in this language, there's a topological ring source that forbids some of the bundles. OK, so even so, let's apply this constraint to Fino. An interesting case is Z3, in which the constraint takes this form. This one is relevant for phenomenology, because in the MSSM, well, in the MSSM it's very natural to write down operators that mediate too fast proton decay. One way you protect yourself against this is by introducing a Z3 or Z6 symmetry called proton trajectory exality. With these charge assignments, and the charge of one generation over the cubic dye-free constraint is 3 modulo 9. So the linear Ibanez-Ross constraint vanishes, but not the cubic ones. That's funny, because to cancel the anomalies, we require a number of generations, which is a multiple of 3. And this is actually related to previous results by phenomenologists, which were trying to embed these guys into a U1. And they find that they can only do it with generation-dependent charges. If they had been able to do it within one generation, then this anomaly would have had to vanish. So yeah. And well, that was the story. I wanna end with an interesting connection, which is, as far as I know, not useful for anything, but it's fun. Which is a connection between the standard model and the topological superconductor, the first system in which we have a dye-free anomaly, okay? So like I mentioned before, this is a T-invariant system of three-dimensional fermions, which has a modulo 16 anomaly because this group is Z16. That's fact number one. Fact number two, take one generation of the standard model with right-handed neutrinos and compute how many vial fermions are there. You'll find that the answer is 16. So I'm gonna show that this is not numerology, that actually these two 16s are the same 16. How do I do that? Well, turns out that once you have right-handed neutrinos, the standard model has a particular Z4 symmetry which acts very simply by multiplication by I. And this is something which actually arises naturally in ground unified theories, because the Z4 is the center of spin 10 in DUTs, okay? Now, remember when I said before that sometimes fermions do not make sense in certain manifolds, but fermions with U1 charges make sense. You can actually do the same thing with the group C4 instead of U1 to get what is called manifolds with a spin C4 structure. These are manifolds in which uncharged fermions make no sense, but fermions charged under a C4 do make sense, and this is what we have in the standard model. In this case, there's a mathematical correspondence that meets homomorphism that relates this group to this group. This group is the guy that controls the anomalies of three-dimensional fermions. And this is the one that controls the anomalies of the standard model in this language. It turns out that the map The data invariant kind of survives this map, so the constraints that you get here are mapped to the constraints that you get here. So they're actually, the two anomalies are related by this homomorphism. This is fine, but this is kind of unsatisfactory. One would like to understand this homomorphism more physically. And the way you understand this is via Higgsing, okay? So suppose that I now introduce a scalar, which is charged with charge 2 under the C4, okay? This is not something, this is not a field in the standard model, but I can just throw in it, see what happens. So it has charge 2, and it can get a BEV. When it gets a BEV, it breaks the symmetry from C4 to C2. And then, but when you do that, it turns out that it's possible to write down mass terms for the standard model fermion. So they become massive, and they cannot have an anomaly, okay? But yeah, that's fine. But we should not forget that the Higgs field that we introduced has charge 2 under the Z4. That means that if the Z4 bundle is non-trivial, it can happen that the Higgs field is forced to vanish. Okay, so because the Higgs field has charge 2 under a C4, it effectively is a section of a Z2 bundle. And the characteristic property of these things, you can look at these guys as a sign. If the bundle is non-trivial, what happens is that if you have one spatial direction here, it can, and in the vertical axis you have the BEV of the Higgs field, what can happen is that boundary conditions along this line are such that you have to glue this with this. These are twisted boundary conditions, which force the Higgs field to vanish at some point. Now, where the Higgs field is forced to vanish, you cannot write down mass terms. So you can expect massless fermion zero modes in this locus. This guy is a co-dimensional one surface, which in general can be non-orientable. So by doing this construction, you force the standard model spectrum to have three-dimensional fermions in this surface, and you can also you can show that these guys have a pin plus structure. So by Higgsing, you turn the standard model into a topological superconductor. Okay. So that's basically it. We're just exploring the whether or not you can have anomalies in particle physics in this case, with the new anomaly constraints. Standard model and guts are anomaly free. You find some anomalies for discrete symmetries. But there's always the possibility to have a topological ring surface coupling. One thing that we wanted to do, but we didn't do, because at some point, most of the work that we did was computing that table that I showed you before about the semi-simple Lie groups. And at some point we just said, enough is enough. The thing that we wanted to do next is to look at things like this, where this Z4 is more general. And there was a nice paper by Wang Wen and Witten, which shows that when you replace this Z4 by SU2, there's actually a new Dyfried anomaly. So that's interesting. And another thing that one might try to think about is to run this story for generalized global symmetries. So for instance, looking back at the standard model with this discrete group, different choices of the discrete group map to different choices of one-form symmetry from the standard model. And at least one can try to classify those, see if there's anything interesting one to say. Okay, well, that's it. Thanks, guys.
Questions for Miguel? There's nothing less than Miguel.